Kenneth, Barbara, Bobby, Virginia, and Susan Martin, known to the Rose City Park community as a cordial and compassionate family, were beloved citizens of 1950s Portland, Oregon. They were the front of the postcard for the post-war American dream, a household of happiness and hope, until it was all cut short by unexplainable, unsolved disappearances and deaths on December 7th, 1958, leaving all who knew them across Multnomah County and Northwest Oregon as a whole, grasping for answers in a sea of evidence that drowned us all in doubt. As a hope to provide more substantial reasoning built upon observable evidence and situational analysis, this is an examination of the Martin family disappearance and the decades worth of mysteries along Columbia River. This is Cold Case Detective. Scrutinized personal details of the Martin family are hard to come by in the present day, due in part to the old age of the case, but also to the small-scale nature of the investigation, and how few survivors of that time period are still around. However, we have gleaned as much information as we can, and will try to paint the most accurate portrait possible of this missing family of five. What we can say for sure is that Kenneth R. Martin, often referred to by his nickname of Ken, was born around 1904 in the state of South Dakota in the upper Midwest region of the United States. His father, Reverend Edward R. Martin, moved Ken and the rest of his family 7 years later to Portland, Oregon, to join the American Sunday School Union. Just 1 year prior, Ken's future wife, Barbara Jean Cable, was born around Brownsville, Oregon in 1910, to recent descendants of Oregon pioneers from the 19th century. The Cable family also moved to Portland just 1 year later in 1911, bringing Barbara and Ken closer than ever before. Barbara enjoyed participating in contests around the county throughout her childhood, winning the first ever Junior Queen title at the Portland Rose Festival, while Ken loved attending the local celebrations on his own. The couple met sometime in the 1920s, marrying and moving in together near the end of the decade, honing in on starting a loving family of their own to raise in the fast-growing city of Portland, Oregon. Their wishes came true on October 28, 1930, when Barbara gave birth to a son, whom they named Donald Kenneth Martin, nicknamed Don for short. Knowing this was only the tip of the iceberg, the Martin couple decided to purchase a bigger home, with future children on their minds. In 1932, Kenneth and Barbara bought a two-story house of the Tudor style at 1715 NE 56th Avenue, fashioned with twin gables and brown siding. It was brand new at the time, sitting nicely in Rose City Park, one of Portland's blossoming neighborhoods and the favorite suburb of both Ken and Barbara's extended families. The name derived from Portland's climate and its correlated abundance of roses, hence its moniker, the City of Roses. However, not everything in Portland was rosy. Just after Ken and Barbara started their family, the rate of organized crime and mob-related businesses in Oregon's biggest port town increased like never before, through the 1940s and into the 1950s. Portland had always been a huge intersection to various trades, such as the lumber and agriculture industries. But as more innocent folks flocked across the United States looking for a new life, so too did underground criminals. Their imported vices included everything from shady nightclubs to gambling rackets, slithering all the way through local government, leading to political corruption among elected officials. Nevertheless, Portland was able to sustain an economic growth fastened above the organized crime due to incredible labor contracts across boating and aviation sectors, and the city flourished as the 1950s came to a close. And as the City of Roses was nurtured, so too was the Martin family. In the years since Don was born, Ken Ken and Barbara decided to try for more children, and successfully gave birth to three, all girls. Barbara, known more frequently as Barbie, born in 1944, Virginia, nicknamed Jenna, born in 1945, and Susan, called Susie, born 1947, were all welcome additions to the Martin family, and fell in love with their Rose City Park neighbors. To put food on the table, Kenneth secured a job at Eccles Electric Home Service Company, working steady hours while making a modest living. Barbara, a clever wordsmith and dedicated reader, was prone to winning sweepstake competitions and jingle writing contests held both locally and nationwide. Thus, she brought in various lucrative prizes and awards, such as exotic vacations, cash, and even a new car. Her evocative and witty writing, combined with Ken's employment, set the entire Martin family on the path towards success. Donald moved a few years after Susie was born, and eventually joined the United States Navy. In the late 1950s, Dom was stationed in New York as a corpsman, after a scandalous stint at the department chain of Meyer and Frank. As the girls got older and the Martins' lives settled down, the family of five continued to thrive. All three of Ken and Barbara's girls fell in love with learning and reading, and the Rose City Park Library soon became a safe haven for the entire Martin clan. When they weren't bringing home boxes worth of books, the girls could be found playing with neighbor friends or helping their parents with household projects and attending parties. Ken himself was known for his famous Santa Claus outfit, dressing up for hundreds of children across the greater Portland suburbs during the holidays, big gray beard and all. In fact, Christmas at the Martin household was always known to be an especially festive front, with the family constantly creating Christmas crafts to fasten all around their property. And, tragically, it was one of the Martin family's excursions into rural Oregon to prepare for a Christmas crafting-filled week that led to their complete reversal of fortune, when the family of five hopped into their 1954 Ford Country Sedan 6 and headed down Highway 30, never to be seen alive again. Let's now turn to the timeline of events that led to the disappearance of the Martin family. On the evening of December 6th, 1958, Ken and Barbara Martin attend a Christmas party at a friend's house in Beaverton, Oregon, with a few other locals. The night goes well, and the Martin couple return to their Rose City Park home without incident. The following morning, at around 8 a.m, Susie and Jenna Martin are the first ones up, and spend the morning reading their newest rentals from the local library, such as The Secret of the Andes. A few minutes later, Barbara Martin joins her daughters and informs them of their plans for the day. Lunch with the Evans family and a journey to the country to collect greens for Christmas decorations. Jenna asks if they can stop at Larch Mountain during their trip to show her friend Joyce the scenery, but Barbara tells Jenna that Joyce is sick and won't be joining them. Between 8:30 and 9 a.m. that same morning, Ken and Barbara have a conversation with Barbie behind closed doors. Barbie makes a case that the family doesn't need to rush out that afternoon to collect Christmas greens, her stubborn adolescent nature beginning to show. The Martin couple informs Barbie that their eldest son, Don, had helped orchestrate this trip from New York, with his love of Christmas convincing his Oregon family to make the excursion that weekend. A little after 9 a.m, Susie departs the Martin residence and goes over to the neighbor's house, where she shoots a BB gun with her friend Doug Deans. At precisely 10:30 a.m, the Evans family arrives at the Martin household, and Susie is beckoned back home by Barbara. Over the next few hours, the Evans and Martin families mingle while the Evans couple's two children and their friends, Marcy Welsh, play with the Martin girls. The adults talk about various things and are interrupted at one point when Marcy phones home and asks Barbara if she and the rest of her family will be attending the Welsh's Sunday dinner, per their weekly custom. Barbara declines, informing her of their afternoon plans to travel to Columbia River Gorge. Just before leaving in the early afternoon hours, Mr. Evans asks Ken one more time if he and the family will go to the Welsh's with them. Again, Ken says no, that they should stick with the plan. When Mr. Evans asks about those plans, all Ken says is that they are just going for a ride. Not long after, the Evans family leaves, and the Martin family prepares for their Christmas Greens adventure. The three girls dress in less than optimal clothing for the chilly early winter weather, while Ken and Barbara stay prepared with extra garments and heavier coats. Just before leaving, Barbara sets her reading glasses on the mantel above the fireplace and brings out a frozen pack of ground beef to thaw in time for when the family returns home to make dinner. Between 1:30 and 2 p.m., the Martin family are seen leaving their Rose City Park neighborhood on two separate occasions. The first is by Frank Womack, who remembers seeing the Martin clan climbing into the station wagon as he washed his own car across the street. He also mentions seeing Ken with two film cameras strung around his neck. The second sighting is by Ella Chin, who sees the Martin family drive by her house a few doors down from 1715 NE 56th Avenue. She notices Jenna's red boots and wonders where the family is going. Just moments later, Ken Martin and company drive by his usual gas station called Walker's Flying A Service Station at the corner of NE 60th Avenue and Halsey Street, opting to get gas further along the trip rather than at its onset. That moment comes a couple of hours later at around 4 p.m. when the Martin family stops at the Chevron service station in Cascade Locks belonging to Dean Baxter to fill up the Ford Country Sedan with 5 US gallons. The detour is short and sweet, and the Martins get back on the road before too long, heading east. Only a few minutes pass by before the Martin family is seen once more by Clara York, a waitress at the Paradise Snack Bar in Hood River, Oregon. They only stay for a short while to grab a quick bite to eat, and Clara would later report that the family acted normally as she served them. At 4:30 p.m., they leave without incident and head westward back towards Portland. This would be the last sighting of the Martin family all together, and all alive. Mere seconds after the Martin family is confirmed to leave the Paradise Snack Bar, a couple from Washington State, Kelsey and Doris Knutson, spot a vehicle matching the description of the Martin family station wagon speeding down the highway, leaving Hood River and heading west. 30 minutes later, just after 5 p.m., the Knutson couple pass by Trotter's Point alongside the Columbia River, where the same speeding station wagon is pulled over. Both Doris and Kelsey remember seeing two people sitting in very close proximity in the front seat, as if they were being squished together. At about the same time, George Zimmer and Robert Epperson, two fishermen coming back from their Sunday catch at Sturgeon Rock, notice two vehicles parked at Trotter's Point. One of them, a light-coloured sedan, reportedly contains a Christmas tree. The other vehicle, an older, dark-coloured model, sits parked by a trash barrel in the lot. Neither vehicle is occupied, but the waning light makes it hard for the men to be sure. This report is supported by another truck driver by the name of Kurt Thompson, who sees a cream-coloured station wagon at the same spot at the same time that night. Another few moments go by, and as Kelsey and Doris drive along Highway 30, a pair of bright headlights zoom up behind their car. The Knutson couple give signals for the belligerent vehicle to pass them, but it continues to ride their tail before eventually careening past them and speeding forward into the twilight of dusk. At around 5:15 p.m., Kelsey and Doris Knutson drive through Cascade Locks and once again spot the same cream-coloured station wagon sitting on a nearby access road beneath the Bridge of the Gods. Two men stand outside the wagon and talk to whoever is inside. After the Knutsons drive by, they do not see the peculiar car again. A day goes by, and the Martin family are not heard from by friends or family. However, over in Hood River County, two ex-convicts, one by the name of Roy Light and the other left nameless, are arrested on Grand Theft Auto charges. The car in question is an abandoned 1951 white Chevrolet, found at Trotter's Point, where the Martin family station wagon was reportedly seen abandoned. Not far from the car, in a patch of bushes, a couple named Mr. and Mrs. Cox recover a 38 Colt Commander covered in dry blood. However, in a complete botch of proper procedure, the gun is never entered into evidence and is returned to the Cox couple. On that same day, Monday, December 9th, Ken Martin fails to show up for work at Eccles Electric Home Service Company. The three Martin girls are all marked absent from school by their teachers, and that night, Ken's boss, Taylor Eccles, files an official missing persons report. At around 11 p.m, Portland police arrive at the Martin residence to search the property. They find the entire household undisturbed, without any signs of foul play at home or anything of value stolen. The next day, authorities check Ken Martin's bank account and find a significant sum left over, leaving them to believe this isn't a runaway situation. Over the next couple of weeks, law enforcement enacts searches both across Multnomah and Hood River counties, everywhere from the seedy alleyways of Portland to the rocky woodlands on Mount Hood, but nothing of note is found. That is, until February of 1959, when a search and rescue volunteer stumbles upon tire tracks in the Dalles, leading from the brush and off the edge of a cliff overlooking the Columbia River. The tire tracks are inspected, and it's confirmed to match the tires on the Martin's station wagon. Investigators find paint chips on the rocks where the tire tracks are and send them into the FBI for proper analysis. The FBI swiftly reports back that the paint on the rocks was the same paint used on the exact make and model of the Martin's car, the 1954 Country Sedan. Later that month, operating with the information about the tire tracks and the paint chippings, law enforcement teams up with the United States Army Corps of Engineers to search the murky, fast-flowing waters of the Columbia River. The Army Corps is able to lower the river's surface level by 5 feet behind the Bonneville Dam, but even with sonar technology, the search comes up empty. All remains quiet on the Martin case until a couple of months later. On May 1st, 1959, a team operating a river drilling rig in the Columbia River near the Dalles, just about where the tire tracks were found on a cliff above, drop their anchor. Instead of landing on the riverbed, the anchor hooks onto something of considerable size and weight, with some of the rig's crew members describing it as the weight of a car. However, before it can be pulled to the surface, the anchor dislodges from the object, and the drilling rig continues down the river. The following morning, on May 2nd, a local couple spots what appears to be two bodies floating downstream on the Columbia River in the direction of Cascade Locks. The couple continues down Highway 30 and again sees the bodies at the Bonneville Dam. The fisherman and his wife call in their sighting, and on the next day, May 3rd, Susan Martin's body is recovered from the Columbia River in Washington, 70 miles west of the Dalles, where the tire tracks were found. Another day goes on, and by May 4th, Virginia Martin's body is recovered at the Bonneville Dam, only 46 miles from the tire tracks, but 24 miles east of her sister's body. Both identities are confirmed via dental records upon arrival at the medical examiner's office. Before the official autopsy, however, a fingerprint technician writes in his report that he believes there to be holes on the sides of the girls' heads. Yet, upon completion of the autopsy, the causes of death are listed as probable drownings, and no gunshot wounds are mentioned. The only other anomaly on the reports reveals pieces of aluminium were found on the clothing of Susan Martin. Both girls are subsequently cremated. Not long after the two girls' bodies are discovered in the Columbia River, investigators return to its banks to expand their search for Ken, Barbara, and Barbie. They utilize sonar and helicopter technology, but underwater searches are eventually called off when the waters are deemed too dangerous and a rescue operative almost loses their life. 7 years pass, and in December of 1966, after the legal probate ends, the only surviving Martin family member, Don, inherits his family's estate. He eventually withdraws from the investigation and restarts his life with a wife and children of his own. 3 years later, on December 29th, 1969, the Martin children's paternal grandmother passes away, and a day later, on December 30th, the urns containing Susan and Virginia's remains are finally claimed by an anonymous individual after 10 years of being left on a shelf in Portland's Riverview Abbey Mausoleum. Police continue searching for clues and potential suspects as the case shifts from theories of an accident to theories of foul play. The two ex-convicts arrested a day after the Martin family went missing are forgotten about, after police are unable to connect them beyond coincidence to the Martin case. And in 1988, lead detective Walter Graven passes away, having never solved his most troubling assigned mystery. The last major search for the Martin family comes in 1999. When Margie Bull renews national interest in the disappearances and organizes a modern-day dive search of the Columbia River. The rescue team, equipped with new sonar capabilities, GPS tools, and underwater acoustic technology, canvass the river from the Dalles to the Cascade Locks, but again find no signs of that long-lost cream-colored station wagon. As of today, the Martin family case remains an active investigation. However, it's still as cold as it ever was. Don Martin has since passed away, and detectives are left sifting through old case files in old file cabinets, praying for an unnoticed piece of evidence that will turn up and provide the key we are all desperately waiting for. Everyone has heard of the famous smoking gun. In criminal investigations, smoking guns are the strongest type of circumstantial evidence, usually referring to an object providing conclusive evidence that a crime was indeed committed. The major case point in the Martins family isn't quite a smoking gun. This wouldn't be a cold case if it was, but it is a gun nonetheless, a gun covered in blood and recovered near the Martin family's last known location, tying together all of the smaller parts within the big, investigative picture. The gun in question, a .38 Colt Commander handgun, was discovered on the west side of Cascade Locks, in a patch of bushes only a couple of miles away from the stolen Chevrolet at Trotter's Point. The gun wasn't found by police, but rather a gentleman named Mr. Cox. Mr. Cox found it not long after the white Chevy was picked up, and turned it into the Hood River County Sheriff's Office when he noticed the dried blood covering the barrel and magazine wall, which had been damaged. There was also a fired shell casing left in the gun's chamber. The presence of the blood led Mr. Cox to believe it had been used to at least pistol whip or club somebody, if not shoot someone at point-blank range. However, while police agreed it appeared to have been used to harm something or someone, and despite it being found near the ex-convict's stolen vehicle, it wasn't entered into evidence. Instead, the local sheriff returned the gun to Mr. Cox, since he discovered it first and repaired the damage it had sustained. There is no explanation as to why exactly the gun wasn't officially processed and the blood tested. Some have suggested that the blood was cleaned off by Mr. Cox when he repaired the firearm. But his wife, Bonnie Cox, refuted those claims, and says her husband turned the gun in as is. With both the Martin family disappearing, and the ex-convict cases happening so close together, it just doesn't make sense why this gun was ignored. That blood could have been the clue detectives needed to tie the cases together. The gun situation would not go away, either. Later on in the investigation, sleuths discovered that the serial number associated with the 38 Colt Commander was traced back to a Meyer and Frank department store. If that sounds familiar, it's because it is. Meyer and Frank was the company Don Martin worked for before he left to join the Navy, the company where he was accused of stealing around $2,000 worth of sporting goods in 1956. And amongst that stolen merchandise was none other than a 38 Colt Commander handgun. The serial numbers matched. Of course, this massive revelation is nothing more than coincidence without physical evidence to prove the bloody gun found by Mr. Cox was used by Don Martin, or someone else, to kill the Martin family. It sounds like an extraordinary accusation, but it is also a taxing stretch of the imagination to think a gun stolen by Don Martin randomly ended up causing the death of at least one of his own family members without his direct involvement. But then again, Don Martin was in New York the day his family disappeared, 3,000 miles away. Could he have hired the two ex-convicts to make his own family disappear, supply them with the murder weapon, and then sit back on the other side of the country while it happened? It's a complex theory that we'll get to later. All we know is the fact that the gun was never entered into evidence, tested for fingerprints or blood samples, and that Roy Light and his unnamed partner were never questioned about it. Also, if we're tossing up the facts we know, we can add that this was undoubtedly some unacceptable and incredibly misjudged police work also. If people go missing, and a stolen car is recovered nearby, and then a short while later a murder weapon is found, doesn't common sense tell oneself to hold onto it? It is one of the most frustrating aspects to the case file, and to this day raises the biggest question mark in an investigation full of them. Now let's turn to the most prominent theories in answering the question of what happened to the Martin family.
Is it really possible for a tiny tweak to your morning coffee routine to ignite your metabolism and put your body into fat-burning mode for the rest of the day? Yes. Thanks to Java Burn, a proprietary formula that, when combined with coffee, is scientifically proven to increase the speed and efficiency of metabolism to deliver unparalleled fat-burning energy. Java Burn is tasteless and instantly dissolves in your coffee. The result? Fat melts off your body. Send your metabolism into overdrive with Java Burn now by clicking the link in the description of this podcast.
1958 was an interesting period in the history of Portland, Oregon. It hadn't quite become the hub of the countercultural movement that we'll see blossom in the 1960s, but it was also no longer the lumber capital of the Pacific Northwest in America. Pioneers seeking manifest destiny were mere history lessons, and transplanted miners of the 1849 California gold rush had since passed away, leaving their grandchildren and great-grandchildren to reforge their family's legacies north of the Golden State. But amidst these people searching for refuge and the American dream were mobsters looking to establish a new organized crime empire on the Pacific coast. Where there's a port city in the United States, there's a good chance racketeers have already targeted it for their latest illicit operations. Portland was no different, and from the end of the Depression until the counterculture explosion, the City of Roses was rife with corruption and crime. Thus, many wonder if behind the Twin Gables and the suburban dressing, Ken Martin had a second life, or at least some significant connection to the Portland mobsters. While Ken was well known in his Rose City Park neighborhood as a good father and a hard-working electrician, it is entirely possible he kept a secret second position running goods or working undercover. While he and Barbara both made stable incomes, he did leave behind a modest estate and certainly wasn't struggling by any means. Those who live by this theory propose that something had gone wrong recently in Ken's involvement with gangsters, or that he'd been asked to be relieved of his role in order to tie up all loose ends. The mob then had both he and his family killed in cold blood, disposed of without evidence left behind. Some people wonder if this would connect the two ex-convicts, Roy Light and his accomplice, to the disappearances. They were already in cahoots with the criminal underworld, and could have been hired by the mob as a third party to erase any thoughts that organized crime played a part in Ken's life. While there is no hard evidence to suggest this theory, it is curious that so many massive policing errors occurred in the investigation following December 7th, such as the mishandling of the gun evidence and the failure to interrogate the ex-cons about it, or the Martin family. Not only that, but some folks point to the medical examiner and the autopsy controversy as hints that bigger players were involved behind the scenes. Remember, a technician working at the scene of the discovery of Susie and Jenna Martin's corpses mentioned he saw what appeared to be bullet holes in each of their heads. But when the coroner gave his report, he never stated such findings and listed the CODs as drownings. Obviously, both men can't be correct. Was the sheriff's office technician seeing things that weren't there, trying to drum up headlines or cast himself in the limelight? Did the medical examiner miss something? Or worse, was the medical examiner paid off by someone in a position of power to gloss over the bullet wounds and avoid marking the deaths as gunshot related? Sadly, we will never be able to double check. The girls' bodies were cremated, destroying the chance for a second opinion. This theory, like so many, requires a certain level of suspending disbelief, because again, there is absolutely zero proof to suggest a massive scheme was put in place to begin with, and the more county officials you rope into this as being complicit, the more far-fetched it becomes. While organized crime had a presence in Portland in 1958, it wasn't a strong hold over the economic health of the city. In fact, despite the rising crime rates in the 40s and 50s, Portland was still known for its growing population and as a destination for many couples looking to start a family. Just because a crime happens near a city where mobsters operate doesn't exactly ensure the crime was committed by mobsters. Honestly, this theory is more driven by our viewpoint of organized crime as portrayed through the lens of pop culture. In reality, it simply doesn't have the vice grip on society we are led to believe. Is it more exciting? Certainly. Can we 100% with certainty rule out Kenneth Martin as a mobster? No. But geographic proximity does not equal complicity. And until a shred of evidence suggests the mob had a role in the disappearance of an innocent family of five, it remains nothing more than an Oregonian folktale. A theory that goes beyond legend and myth-making, and feels much more realistic, is that the Martin family's fate wasn't at the hands of their father's secret musings, but rather at the hands of their father himself. Some people wonder if Kenneth Martin had actually lost his job, or had a deteriorating crisis on his hands that led him to take his family beyond the countryside and end their lives, before driving the car off the banks of the Columbia River. This would explain the tire tracks found at the Dalles, as well as Ken's tepid response to Mr. Evans when he rejected their invite to dinner that Sunday evening, instead telling him the family better stick to the plan. Was this the plan all along? It is possible, however unlikely. Again, the Martin family was under no financial burden. Barbara's rewards and prize money from her jingle contest winnings were perfect for supplementing Ken's income, so even if he was worried about losing his job, the family wouldn't have been without backup funds. In addition, police interviewed Ken's boss, Taylor Eccles, at Eccles Electric Home Service Company, who filed the official missing persons report. Taylor never mentioned the prospect of Ken being fired or getting laid off. Also, remember that Ken was leaving behind a healthy estate, suggesting he had plenty of capital remaining just before he disappeared. Friends and family also never mentioned deteriorating mental health or suspicious behavior anyway, so if Ken was dealing with emotional or psychological distress, he was doing so in perfect disguise, with neither his own family nor the people around him noticing anything. So if the Martin family disappeared not at the hands of their father or his imaginary connections to Portland gangsters, by whose hand did they disappear? The obvious choices are Roy Light and his still anonymous cohort, the two ex-convicts arrested 24 hours after the Martins vanished. They both had criminal backgrounds. They had stolen a vehicle left behind near the Martins' last location. Roy lived near an aluminium plant not far from the cliff with the tire tracks, and most suspicious of all, both men were seen with the Martin family just before dusk on December 7th, 1958. The Paradise snack bar waiter who worked with Clara York, the woman who served Ken, Barbara, Barbie, Jenna, and Susie, claims to have served Roy and his partner during the same shift. In fact, she says they were at the restaurant at the same time, and the ex-cons left just after the Martin family. This was never corroborated by other patrons or Clara York, but it was also a known fact that Roy Light was an acquaintance of the waiter who gave this testimony. If the two were friends, it doesn't make sense for the waiter to lie about it, unless their friendship had grown sour and he wanted to connect Roy to the disappearances out of spite.
If you want tips and strategies on how to start, grow, and monetize your business online, check out the Digital Revolution podcast with Eli Adams. We interview digital experts from around the world that share their personal stories. They talk about what they're currently working on and where they see the future going. But most importantly, they share tactics in their specific area of expertise with the hope of helping you improve your digital presence online. You can listen to the Digital Revolution podcast on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, iHeartRadio, or wherever else you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
Nevertheless, that's not the only strange occurrence revolving around Roy and his cohort. Remember, there were multiple eyewitnesses who claimed to have seen a vehicle matching the description of the Martin family's 1954 Ford Country sedan pulled over at different points along Highway 30, idling next to a second car occupied by two men. None of these witnesses could positively identify the occupants, nor these vehicles themselves, as either the Martin family, the convicts, or their respective cars. But it is peculiar. Sure, it could just be a coincidence that Roy Light and the man he was with stole a car and abandoned it at the same time the Martins went missing, but it would also make sense if the convicts were looking for an innocent target to rob, extort, and leave them to die when they were finished. Now, why two men who were finally free of prison would take on an entire family of five who had nothing more than a pine tree and a few greens is as good a question as any. But the Martins' station wagon was considered to be in top shape. Maybe Roy and his cohort wanted to switch rides to disguise their flight cross-country. Then, when Ken and company put up a fight, the men decided against it and pushed them off the cliffs into the river. It's possible the car seen by the Knutson couple and the fisherman and the truck driver wasn't the Martin family station wagon too. It's not as if they were the only ones with a cream-coloured Ford sedan. Maybe it was a different family, just receiving help from a concerned passerby. Or if it was the Martin family, maybe that second car with the two men was just hired help. And even if those two men seen with the dark-coloured car were responsible for the Martins' deaths, it could have been completely different men, and not necessarily Roy Light and his friend. It would be another huge coincidence, but it can't be ruled out. Without a doubt, the most popular theory surrounding the case supposes that not only were Roy Light and the other ex-con responsible for killing the Martin family, but that they were hired by the eldest Martin child, Don. To understand the depths of this theory, one must go beyond the events of the 1958 holiday season and into Don's conflicted past with his own kin. As Don entered adulthood and his parents had more children, Don's own relationship with Ken and Barbara began to fracture. He hadn't gone out and written some huge success story, and found himself in trouble with the law more than once. This, of course, bothered his parents, and their acceptance of him began to fray. When Don's biggest scandal occurred in 1956, in which he was accused of stealing $2,000 of merchandise from a sporting goods store, Ken and Barbara sent him to a religious college in Connecticut to try and reset his erratic behavior. However, some have said that the Meyer and Frank's theft accusations aren't what prompted their decision. The store manager at Meyer and Frank's would later report that Don had confided in him that his relationship with his parents was destroyed because they had found out he was in an affair with another man and they did not approve. This obviously pained Don to feel persecuted by his own family, and he felt, perhaps understandably, betrayed by their refusal to accept him and attempts to convert him via religious schooling. This fractured relationship showed its true colors most of all after the Martin family disappeared. After Don moved to New York State, he never returned to Oregon to help aid in the search for his parents and sisters. Instead, he waited until March of 1959 to fly to Portland and settle their estate. He was the only beneficiary, after all. Then, when Susie and Jenna's bodies were recovered from the river, Don didn't travel west and missed the memorial service, later saying he just messed up the dates in his head. However, the cremated remains of his sisters ended up going unclaimed for 10 years, again ignored by Don. Eventually, Don left the US Navy and moved to Hawaii, where he married and had children of his own. He died in 2004, but not before giving answers to the questions about the piece of evidence most damning to his potential involvement, the .38 Colt Commander handgun. Don was adamant that he did not steal the gun in question, but rather that it was taken by his co-worker and roommate at the time, a man by the name of Wayne. This reveal was followed by interviews with Wayne himself, who also dismissed the idea that he had stolen the gun found by Mr. Cox in the bushes off Highway 30. However, he did inform reporters that Don had indeed been in a relationship with another man, and this had estranged him from his family when they learned of it. Wayne went as far to say that it was possible Don was the man behind his own family's disappearance, that he could have hired someone to take them out, so he may inherit their estate, furious at them for their treatment of him and their reaction to his sexual partners. It's unknown if Wayne was ever officially questioned by police, but his statements are quite alarming, combined with the Colt Commander evidence. There is no reason to believe Don didn't steal the merchandise, and because the gun's serial number matched the one missing from Meyer and Frank's, it leads us to believe they were in fact the same gun. So, if Don had stolen the gun and it ended up near a potential crime scene 2 years later, what happened in between? Don may have left it behind and then passed it on to whoever he hired to kidnap and kill the rest of the Martin clan. He may have been in New York in 1958, but Don could have set the plan in motion long before the morning of December 7th. Remember, he was the one who organized the Martins' trip to the countryside to collect Christmas greens in the first place. Maybe that's why Ken and Barbara had been so adamant about going that Sunday afternoon, because Don had insisted on it. Maybe he had promised reconciliation, or even lied and said he would meet them there, when in fact he was still in New York, waiting for his hired hands to do his bidding. It would at least give Don an alibi from being physically involved in the disappearances, and would be the perfect lure for his unsuspecting family. And, in the end, the modest estate left behind in the wake of the Martins' disappearances probably wasn't even the motivating factor. Maybe it helped Don pay off the actual killers, but if he was involved himself, it was probably for an emotional reckoning, remorseless revenge to the highest degree. It should be said that as strong as this theory is, it isn't without faults. Most pressing of all is this. Would Don really be careless enough to use a gun he had been accused of stealing in a major controversy just 2 years prior? It was 1958. There were plenty of ways to obtain a firearm without leaving a trace. Also, if Don hired the ex-cons to kidnap his family, why wouldn't they just use their own firearm? Men of their background would have an even easier route to securing untraceable weaponry. Plus, hiring ex-cons to commit a crime might be easier than hiring men without a history of violent crimes, but hiring locals would also create more problems than it would solve. Not to mention, Don was 3,000 miles from home, and conducting an abduction and set of five murders so far away seems a bit convoluted. There is no arguing that Don had an emotional motive, and his behavior after their disappearances does scream guilty. But remember, the man had been scarred by his own parents for rejecting their son's own identity. He may not have had them killed, but he was told his sexuality wasn't going to be accepted, a devastating proposition in and of itself. Don did have every right to be upset with his family, even after they went missing. Does it appear cold and calculating? Of course. Does it justify murder? Absolutely not. But the trauma of vilification and rejection for your sexual identity can run deep. He may have just been too hurt to find closure in that moment. Regardless, it's an unbelievably complex situation, and yet it provides us with the most plausible theory, despite the arguments against it. Before we divulge our hypothesis of Ken, Barbara, Barbie, Virginia, and Susan Martin's unsolved disappearances, we want to make it known that our conclusions presented in Cold Case Detective are purely logical speculation based on evidence, circumstance, and factual subtext. We are only privy to the same information presented in each episode, and we do not attempt to promise certainty or an expert guarantee on the findings we reach in closing. We simply observe, research, and report. In a case like the Martin family's deaths and disappearances, in which five people vanish from the face of the earth, and in which all signs point to foul play, it's hard to imagine their fate didn't rest in the hands of someone with motive. It's rare to find a case in true crime lore of entire families being kidnapped and killed for no reason. Sometimes you'll find an instance of a robbery gone wrong or mistaken identity, but again, these cases are few and far between. Thus, we believe that considering motive had to play a massive role in the murder of five innocent people, Don Martin most likely had a significant role in his family's deaths. Before we go any further, we want to emphasize that Don's connection to the events of December 7th, 1958 are purely coincidental. He had an alibi. He was 3,000 miles away at the time. He wasn't the one who literally pulled the trigger. However, we keep circling back to the blood-stained gun found along Highway 30 that matched the serial number of the exact same make and model Don was accused of stealing in 1956. The odds of that exact scenario just happening by chance are astronomical and too suspicious to ignore. That .38 Colt Commander was used to club someone. It had been damaged at the magazine wall, and the dried blood was in excess. It was definitely a murder weapon, and the location of its discovery was a huge hint that it had been thrown out of a car window after whatever crime occurred. Was said crime the murder of the Martin family, or one of its members? It seems likely, but we will never know for sure, since the gun was fixed, cleaned, and the shell casing removed, and all physical evidence it held was wiped away into nothingness. So if the stolen .38 Colt Commander was used in the Martin family's disappearance, but Don was 3,000 miles away, who fired the gun? We believe Don was the orchestrator. He convinced his family to go out to the country at a specific time, Sunday afternoon, when he knew traffic would be light and the chance at eyewitnesses would be slim. He also disguised the event as a normal occurrence. Don was known to be a huge Christmas lover and passionate about the holiday. The Martin family was also known to collect and craft Christmas greens each December anyway, so his suggestion of the activity would appear perfectly innocent and not at all out of the ordinary. Then, Don hired the actual gunman, at least two men, with maybe a third to help dispose of the evidence, and instructed them to attack at dusk. The waning light would cloak the criminals in the shadows of twilight, and make dumping the car at the river even more discreet. We do believe that the sightings made by the fishermen, passing drivers, and the Knutson couple were of the Martin family, just before vanishing, and the men who had stopped them and leant into their car to talk to them were the killers themselves. Whether the men conned the family as hitchhikers, or just straight up hijacked the vehicle, is up to anyone to guess. However they did it, they were skilled enough to subdue two adults and three grown children. Then the suspects drove them back towards the Dalles, and under the black of night, tied the family up, shot the parents, and pushed the 1954 Ford Country sedan into the Columbia River. Who could these killers be? Well, Roy Light and his unnamed crony seem like perfect fits. While their stolen white Chevy didn't match the descriptions given by the witnesses who placed the Martin family car along Highway 30, their criminal histories and the fact that they left the Paradise snack bar at the same time as the Martins make them the most likely suspects. It is incredibly frustrating that they were never questioned. Just another abysmal failure in the list of shoddy police work in the days and months following the case's onset. In the end, there is just too much shady business revolving around Don Martin to write him off. Whether it be the circumstantial gun factor, or his estrangement from his family, or the fact that he ignored them altogether after their investigation began, it all adds up to something very suspicious. Not only that, in the mid-2000s, Coin TV did a special investigative report on the case to renew local interest. Part of the report detailed old documents and journals written by the lead detective on the case, former Multnomah County Sheriff's Office Detective Walter Graven. In one of his personal notebooks, all the way in the back pages, Walter had written, just before his retirement, quote, "Had to be planned by blank. No one else with motive. The name is scratched out, but the size and shape of the blacked out name fits perfectly with the word Donald." On Walter's part, this is guesswork, but if Walter Graven felt the same as we do, it must be the strongest theory law enforcement has. Sadly, Don died in 2004, the truth vanishing along with him. Nevertheless, no matter what theory you ascribe to, the fact remains that five innocent Portland natives lost their lives that Christmas season of 1958. None of them deserved to go so soon, and three of them hadn't even reached adulthood. Ken was a devout community member, Barbara a clever and creative soul, Barbie was a highly intelligent teenager, primed to do great things throughout high school and beyond. Jenna and Susie were bright and tenacious bookworms, constantly absorbing knowledge and never letting up on learning. All of them had so much left to give. And if anything, their story reminds us of how important family can be, and how, at any given moment, those closest to us may not be there tomorrow. The Martin family are a reminder to cherish the loved ones around us, and reach out to those who matter most. Not just for you or for them, but for the memories of the Martin family. A family who, before a senseless disappearance and confounding mystery, was a living, breathing home of five remarkable human beings. Once upon a time in Oregon. This is Cold Case Detective. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cold Case Detective Podcast. Should you wish to delve deeper into the mystery, you can follow the case file link included in the show notes, which contains important photographs, documents, maps, and further reading relevant to the case. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by leaving a 5-star rating wherever you listen. It really helps us expand our reach and bring awareness to the cases we cover. If you would like us to investigate a specific case, perhaps even one close to home or that of a loved one, please fill out the submission form in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you in a fortnight with a new episode.